This is the last day of this July 2010 seven-day session. We'll take up another koan today. This is from the other most well-known koan collection, the Blue Cliff Record. This is number 67. The Great Bodhisattva Fu lectures on the Diamond Sutra. Emperor Wu of Liang asked the Great Bodhisattva Fu to expound the Diamond Sutra. Fu mounted the platform, struck the lectern with his baton, and descended from the platform. The emperor was dumbfounded. Master Qi said to him, "Does your majesty understand?" The emperor replied, "No, I do not understand." Master Qi said, "The great Bodhisattva has expounded the sutra thoroughly." This what is referred to as the great Bodhisattva Fu is more, I think, more widely known as Fudaishi. Fudaishi is, in the annals of Zen, is considered one of the three, sort of in a class of three great enlightened lay people. There weren't many that have made it through to the records, but it's Fudaishi, Vimalakirti, and Layman Pong. Fudaishi's dates, he lived a long time ago. He was born in 497 and died in 569. I'm reading now from the Golden... I'm reading from Zen Dust by Ruth from Ruth Fuller Sasaki. This was the authoritative source on the biographies of the masters for the first 30 years I was practicing, until Andy Ferguson's the book came along, Zen's Chinese Heritage. And there is nothing on Fudaishi in Zen's Chinese Heritage, so we're turning back to this good friend of a book. She writes, Fudaishi is one of the most popular and interesting figures of early Chinese Buddhism. So many marvelous stories and legends have grown up around him that it is difficult to separate fact from fancy. And then the biography that she presents here is based on his traditional biography. As a youth, he was a kind and simple fellow who spent much of his time fishing. When he had filled his basket with fish, he would put it into the deep part of the river and say, "Those who want to go, go. Those who want to stay, stay." The people of his village naturally thought him somewhat daft. At 16, he was married, and he and his wife had two sons. People married much earlier in ancient times. They live not nearly as long also. When he was 24, he was sitting one day on the riverbank fishing when a foreign monk, must have been an Indian, a monk from India, came along and spoke to him about the teachings of the Buddha. Fudaishi was deeply moved and immediately threw away all his fishing implements. He then built a little hut for himself and his family under a pair of sala trees at the foot of a nearby mountain. As we'll see, he seemed always drawn to ascetic practices, and we read here, when he had attained some degree of enlightenment as the result of his ascetic practices, he took a different name that means bodhisattva, the bodhisattva who will attain emancipation under the twin sala trees. I'm almost sure that would become a nickname here in the United States. About asceticism, though, surely most people here know the story of the Buddha and his own quest for enlightenment, where he began with 6 years of grueling asceticism, which at the time in India was a very esteemed path, spiritual path, and the idea being that if you could somehow deny your body its appetites and its cravings thoroughly enough, completely enough, that you could reach moksha, liberation. The Buddha, or at the time, Siddhartha was someone of such tremendous willpower that he really went to the limit of his self-punishment and actually attracted a small following of people who were inspired by the depths of his ascetic practices. But then he was on the verge of death from starvation when he realized that this wasn't going to work. He would die before attaining enlightenment. And that's when he saw the wisdom of what came to be known as the Middle Way. It's like one of the translations of Buddhism, the Middle Way. The middle way between asceticism and self-indulgence. Now, everything depends, of course, on how we understand these terms. The Buddha might consider the lifestyle of a middle-class American as self-indulgent. Who knows? But he rejected both of them. So, to read here that Fudaishi had attained a degree of enlightenment as a result of his ascetic practices, you've got to just wonder a little bit about that. I wouldn't say it's impossible. To fast can bring the mind to a great clarity and sharpness. But this was 1500 years ago, so we can't know about everything in such an account. We read, during the day he and his wife worked in their fields raising vegetables or hired themselves out as manual laborers. I think of the Mexican day laborers that are becoming more widespread in the cities in the United States now. At night, Fudaishi talked about the Buddha Dharma to anyone who cared to come and join him. After subjecting himself to severe ascetic discipline for 7 years, he had visions in which three Buddhas appeared to him. But the district official thought him possessed of a demon and locked him up in prison. 10 days later, when the official went to see the Daishi, he found him well and in good spirits, though he had had no food during the entire interval. The official was conscience-stricken and released him and sent him home. Yeah, well, 10 days isn't that long to fast. done several long fasts. The longest was 8 days, and found that I could run a couple miles throughout every day, throughout the fast. Different people respond differently to fasting. I always found it relatively easy. When I was in Japan, I asked Tangen Roshi about something that appears in the Three Pillars of Zen, attributed to Basui's discourse on one mind. And in there, Basui says, "Do not fast. It is not a Buddhist practice." And Roshi Kaplow had done his share of fasting, and he's the one who turned me onto it. And we both always found it really had many benefits to it. So I asked Tangen Roshi, "What about that statement?" And as you might expect, he said, "Well, it depends on what you mean by fasting." But, you know, this isn't for someone. This is where we can cite the Buddha's words about believing what squares with your own experience. I would discourage anyone from fasting during a sesshin. Every once in a while, someone asks me before sesshin whether I think it's a good idea, and I say no. But otherwise, it can be very cleansing and purifying. When he was in his 30s, Fudaishi's, the district he was living in, was stricken with famine. The Daishi sold his house and fields, and with the money obtained food to feed the starving villagers. He also persuaded his wife and sons, as well as a number of other persons, to be sold as slaves in order to raise money for the same purpose. This is would be hard for most of us to get our minds around that. A few months later, however, all the women, including the Daishi's wife, were freed by the landowner who had bought them. We can hardly imagine the conditions at the time, ancient China, and the customs. In 534, the Daishi dispatched a disciple with a letter setting forth his religious views to the emperor. And this is the Emperor Wu, who appears in today's koan. This was the same emperor who had his famous encounter with Bodhidharma soon after Bodhidharma arrived in China, where the emperor asked Bodhidharma, "What is the first principle of the holy teaching?" Bodhidharma said, "Vast emptiness, nothing that can be called holy." And the emperor said, "But who is standing before me? Who are you then?" Because naturally, Bodhidharma's fame as a holy man had spread. And this is where Bodhidharma said, "I don't know." Later the same year, the emperor commanded Fudaishi to appear at court for an audience. He was much impressed with him and ordered him to live at a certain temple near the capital, just outside. The capital then was present-day Nanjing. And now many eminent monks were drawn to the Daishi's gate, and the emperor summoned him for several more audiences. But when Fudaishi was 38, he returned to his old home and built a Buddha hall and a pagoda under the sala trees there. When he was 51, the Daishi gave away all his fields and estates to the people. The following month, he told his followers that he was going to go without food in order to purify his mind and body, and that on the eighth day of the fourth month, he would immolate himself by fire as an offering to the three treasures for the benefit of all living creatures on earth. And we're told here that he hoped that by doing this, he could bring an end to the suffering the people were undergoing as the result of the military disasters at the end of the Ryō dynasty. This naturally brings up memories, images of the Vietnamese monks who died by self-immolation as a protest against the war. Here too, for 21st century Westerners, this seems like a kind of a horrific thing to do. Maybe to some people it's nothing more than suicide. But I take Roshi Kaplow's view that this is not suicide as we ordinarily think of it. This was a great, great cry that rang throughout the world in photographs, crying out with a broken heart at the tremendous violence that was happening at the time. And who can say that it didn't have the desired effect, that those photos of the monks in flames didn't seize the attention of Americans and our government in a way that may have shortened the war at least. It's the most remarkable photograph, not just because they're in flames, but because of the posture. This one in particular, this one Vietnamese monk, he is sitting with his back ramrod straight, perfect posture, chin tucked in, head straight, shoulders relaxed in the lotus posture, in flames. Even those of us who at the time knew nothing about the profound nature of the Zazen posture couldn't help but instinctively sense that there was something really extraordinary there that distinguished it from ordinary suicide. When the day for his immolation came, 19 of his disciples wanted to burn themselves in his place in order to persuade the Daishi not to carry out his intention. And then he finally yielded to their pleas. Some years later, when famine again stalked the land, the Daishi worked in the fields with his followers, gathering grass and acorns for gruel. Everything he had, he gave to the poor and the starving. During the years that followed, the Daishi continued his ministrations to the poor, held great religious meetings regularly to exorcise evil spirits and prevent misfortunes, and continued to purify his mind and body by extreme ascetic practices, hoping thus to bring peace and ease to all beings. He died in the year 569 at the age of 73. Everyone considered him to have been an incarnation of Maitreya. Maitreya is said to be the Buddha of the next world cycle. Earlier in Sesshin, we heard Wumen, Master Wumen, refer to Kashyapa Buddha. That's, we're told, was the Buddha of the last world cycle, and Maitreya is supposed to be the one of the next world cycle. Fudaishi had never been ordained, but remained a layman during his entire life. He was often portrayed in painting and sculpture with his wife and two boys. He was a tall figure with a long beard, wearing a Confucian hat, a Buddhist robe, and Taoist shoes. He is credited with the invention of the revolving bookcase for holding sutras, which was similar to the prayer wheel that you see in Tibet, where the idea is that even the illiterate, by turning these wheels, can find some kind of liberation, supposedly. This thing about him wearing a Confucian hat, a Buddhist robe, and Taoist shoes, that sounds very much like historical revisionism. These were the three great faiths or creeds in China. And there were hundreds of years where the three of them sort of vied for followers. And it sounds like someone decided that we'll just put them all into one guy. That's all the material we have on Fudaishi. And now, turning to another text. This is the commentary on the Buccleuch Record by Thomas and J.C. Cleary. And we have a little more historical background here. First, about this Emperor Wu. After he assumed the throne, he made new commentaries on the five Confucian classics and expounded them. So this is someone who at least considered himself a real follower of the Dharma. It says he served Huang Lao, and it says in parentheses, Taoism, very faithfully, and his nature was most filial. One day he thought of attaining the transmundane teaching in order to requite his parents' toil. This would be a strong Confucian movement with a filial piety, the devotion to one's parents, and gratitude for their labors, their effort in raising him. At this point, he abandoned Taoism and served Buddhism. Then he received the Bodhisattva precepts, meaning he took Jukai, and he put on Buddhist vestments and personally expounded the light-emitting wisdom sutra to recompense his parents. So this emperor clearly sees himself as some authority on the Dharma. But there's no evidence for that. And then this third character, this Master Qi in the koan, At the time, this Mahasattva Master Chi was manifesting wonders and confusing people, so he was confined to prison. Master Chi, just to give you the record, Master Chi then reproduced his body and wandered around teaching in the city. The emperor one day found out about this and was inspired. He esteemed Chi most highly. Master Chi time and again practiced protective concealment. His disappearances and appearances were incomprehensible. There's a lot of superstition in Chinese Buddhism. And now just the background that led up to this encounter of today's koan. When the Mahasattva Fudaishi was going to go into the city of Nanjing to sell fish, at that time the Emperor Wu happened to request Master Chi to expound the Diamond Cutter Sutra. That's what we call the Diamond Sutra. Chi begged off. He said, "This poor wayfarer," that's the old direct translation of a Buddhist monk, "this poor wayfarer cannot expound it, but in the marketplace there is a Mahasattva Fu who is able to expound the sutra." And so the emperor issued an imperial order to summon Fudaishi to the inner palace. And that brings us up to how this koan begins. Fudaishi mounted the platform, struck the lectern with his baton, and descended from the platform. The emperor was dumbfounded. Now, what Fudaishi did, this striking of the platform, the lectern rather, is not unrelated to the teachings of the Diamond Sutra. The Diamond Sutra is one of the four or five sutras most highly esteemed in the Zen school. The different schools of Buddhism have their favorite sutras. And in Zen, it's the Diamond Sutra, the Lotus Sutra, the Vimalakirti Sutra, the Platform Sutra of the Sixth Patriarch, and the Sharangama Sutra. The Diamond Sutra, of all, places the greatest emphasis on the core experience in Buddhism, the experience and the core teaching of emptiness. Shunyata. That this world of phenomena that we move through every day, our whole lives, that this world of phenomena is just one of the two aspects of reality. The other, which is not apprehended by most people ever in their lives, is the realm of emptiness, non-form. The Diamond Sutra also emphasizes that the truth, reality, is beyond both existence and non-existence. Here are other points of the Diamond Sutra, actually quotes, passages from the Diamond Sutra. Arouse the mind without its abiding anywhere. Think of these in terms of him striking the lectern. There is no Dharma to be preached, and that is called Dharma preaching. Past mind is unattainable, present mind is unattainable, future mind is unattainable. Another sutra, not the Diamond Sutra, but another one, says, "You preached nothing, I heard nothing. No preaching and no hearing. That is true prajna, prajna wisdom." There's a famous saying in Buddhism. It goes back to the Buddha himself. He said it. It goes like this: hear the truth, practice it, realize it. The emphasis in the real, genuine, authentic practice of Zen has always been on hearing it. Hearing, one could argue, hearing is the keenest of our senses, the most penetrating of the senses. There are stories, many stories in the texts, the old Zen texts, of those coming to enlightenment through an unexpected sound. There's only one that I've ever heard of coming to enlightenment through reading. There is a koan in the Mumonkan that goes like this. It's called Kyozan's Dream Talk. Kyozan dreamed he went to Maitreya's place and was shown to the third seat. A senior monk struck with a gavel and announced, "Today the talk will be given by the one in the third seat." Kyozan stood up, struck with a gavel, and said, "The truth of the Mahayana is beyond the four propositions and transcends the 100 negations. Listen carefully." Hearing relies on not just sound, but silence. There can be no hearing without silence. This is an example of the central doctrine in Buddhism, which is the law of dependent co-arising, which means, very briefly, that no thing can exist apart from and separate from anything else. It just a moment's reflection will show us that sound depends on silence, and silence depends on sound. These two are merely relative, and both at source are emptiness. If you have nothing but sound, you won't hear sound. If you're someone were whispering next to you and while you were operating a chainsaw, you wouldn't hear it. It has to stand in contrast to silence. Just as form has to stand in contradistinction to emptiness. The circle calligraphy outside the zendo at the end of the hall, there would be no black we could see without the white. This koan also is similar to another one where the Buddha comes before the assembly, and everyone is waiting expectantly for one of his great discourses, just as they would have been here in this koan with Fudaishi. And instead of preaching, instead of giving a sermon, he just holds up a flower and smiles. There's another koan where the master just takes a seat before the assembly and says nothing. Fudaishi certainly could have done that in this koan, but instead he chooses to other things, Fudaishi is declaring, this is it. This. Not part of it. It's it. Each one of us is not part of it. Each one of us, singly, is it. Master Chi asks him, does your majesty understand? This is something of a replay from the emperor's encounter with Bodhidharma. There too, Master Chi said, does your majesty understand? The emperor here, as he did there, he says, honestly, no, I do not understand. Master Chi said, the great Bodhisattva has expounded the sutra thoroughly. This comment by Master Chi itself was referred to by a later Zen master who said it was like a cup of referring to the encounter followed by the comment by Master Chi. It was like a cup of fine wine which was diluted with water by Master Chi. Like a bowl of soup being polluted by Master Chi with a piece of rat shit. another commentator showed more appreciation for the way these two were working together, the Fudaishi and this Master Chi. He said, this is one man acting as the head and one acting as the tail. But it was so eloquent, that strike of the stick, so complete. What a shame the Master Chi had to add to it. Time is up. We'll stop now and recite the four vows.